London's Wigmore Hall. And there's more Beethoven in the concert too, his second piano sonata, and music by his one-time teacher, Joseph Haydn. The pianist is Angela Hewitt, and she rounds off her recital with Bach, his chromatic fantasy and fugue in D minor, the chromatic fantasy taking us deep into the world of Bach's art as an improviser. That's tomorrow's Radio 3 Lunchtime Concert, live from London's Wigmore Hall at just after the 1 o'clock news. Tomorrow night, we're live at the Royal Opera House.
Opera on Three features Mark Antony Turnage's career-making first opera, Greek. With Turnage's typically muscular fusion of classical and jazz influences and a hard-hitting libretto adapted from the Stephen Berkoff play, Greek is a modern take on the Oedipus story, relocated to the East End of London. Baritone Marcus Farnsworth sings the lead role of Eddie in Music Theatre Wales' award-winning production of Greek by Mark Antony Turnage. Opera on Three with me, Sarah Moore Peach, tomorrow at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
2 o'clock this Sunday afternoon, and now this week's edition of the Early Music Show with Lucy Skeeping.
It's a romantic image, isn't it? Old Bach, blind and lying on his deathbed, dictating to his son in a vain attempt to complete his final and greatest achievement. Over this fugue, where the name Bach appears in the counter subject, the composer died. The last moments of genius and a touching story. But is that really what happened? Those words are indeed written on the final page of what many consider to be Bach's greatest achievement, the Art of Fugue. But the truth is that Bach had composed it almost a decade earlier, and it was already being engraved for publication when he died. The Art of Fugue is certainly a work that's been misunderstood. There are questions about what instrument or instruments it was written for what purpose, and how Bach actually meant it to finish. In today's Early Music Show, we're exploring the Art of Fugue, the last of Bach's great monothematic cycles, hearing some of the pieces played in a variety of instrumentation to give us an idea of the different ways musicians have approached it over the years, and to hold our hands as we wade through all the controversy that surrounds this extraordinary work. The Bach expert Simon Hayes is with me in the studio, who will, I hope, explain some of the most up-to-date theories about its provenance. But before we hear from Simon, let's have some more music. This is the opening of the work, played on the organ, by Herbert Takezi.
Thank you. The Art of Fugue was a large-scale project which Bach was preoccupied with really during the last decade or so of his life. And he was exploring the rather exciting idea of the contrapuntal possibilities of a single theme. And he begins by exploring how this theme can be combined with itself. And later on in the collection, things become a bit more complicated, as you'd expect. And he combines this theme with new themes, and we get much more complicated structures. Ultimately, he starts to vary this theme. And that is really one of the most exciting things about the Art of Fugue, that it is based on a varying theme all the way through, which audibly connects all 18 movements.
And they're all more or less in the same key, I think.
D minor, yes, that's right. All connected by the same key. So he's got to have plenty of variety in order to kind of be, you know, make D minor sound exciting.
Did Bach himself call it the Art of Fugue? That sounds rather sort of modern kind of title for someone like Bach.
No, he doesn't use the word a fugue at all anywhere. And all the individual movements actually are referred to as a contrapunctus, which is sort of a variant of the word contrapuntal. It's his son-in-law, a chap called Johann Friedrich Altnikol, who uses the term the Art of Fugue. That's what he writes on Bach's autograph manuscript. But, you know, I wonder, the Art of Fugue contains canons and it's about contrapunctus, so maybe we should think of it as really the art of counterpoint. Or is it too late for that?
Thank you.
Contrapuntus number 6 in 4 parts in the French style. And the pianist there was Pierre-Laurent Aimard. So Simon Hayes, the Art of Fugue is clearly a work of great intellect, you could say. Who was it written for?
No, I think there are lots of possibilities, but just one certainty, and that's that the Art of Fugue was never formally commissioned by anybody. I think it's a personal work, really. Bach had that sort of crossword puzzle setter's mind, and I think he actually enjoyed writing fugues. He did it for pleasure, which is unusual. Baroque composers didn't usually compose for fun. But I think Bach also had a more serious purpose in mind. He was custodian of a wonderful collection called the Old Bach Archive of music written by his predecessors and other members of the Bach family. And I wonder whether he didn't intend the Art of Fugue for this collection to show that he was, you know, one of the great Bach heirs to a wonderful tradition. But could he have had wider ambitions too? Yeah, I wonder whether even in his own lifetime he realised that what he was going to be remembered for was as a master of fugue. So in a way, he wanted to provide something, an ultimate exposition on fugue that really people could latch onto, that would preserve his memory after his death. And I think that's why he made, you know, strenuous efforts to publish the work. So it was really a public testimony. And this is, you know, typically Bachian psychology, you know, to excel himself and others.
I mean, one way, I guess, that we can sort of really understand the work is to sort of really get under the skin of the historical context. I mean, Bach was at the time the cantor of St. Thomas's in Leipzig, and he was also very involved in the city's musical scene in general. What was the intellectual life like in Leipzig at the time?
Well, Leipzig, of course, was a university city, and so many of Bach's colleagues and friends and pupils were well-read, well-educated university men with broad interests in the humanities, including music. And I think by the 1740s, frankly, Bach was bored. You know, he was really bored with his everyday duties as cantor of Leipzig, and living in St. Thomas's school, you know, surrounded by all that, he must have been looking for and hungry for intellectual stimulation elsewhere. And he found it. I mean, the town was full of very interesting intellectuals, including a wonderful chap called Johann Heinrich Winkler. And Winkler must have electrified Bach because he gave him a copy of his book, which was all about groundbreaking work on a new thing called electricity.
That early?
Very early. And it was this it was the science of music, I think, which was very hotly debated in Leipzig at this time. And one of the most interesting people that Bach got to know was a chap called Lawrence Christoph Mitzler, who in 1738 sets up a musical science society. And there were all sorts of wonderful regulations. You had to submit a portrait of yourself and on a regular basis submit a kind of a work which was somehow musically scientific, or it could be a paper. And Telemann and Handel were also members of this society. We know that in 1747, Bach submitted his musical offering to the society. And it's possible that in 1748 he was intending to submit the Art of Fugue.
Yes, yeah, certainly got that sort of scientific feel about it, hasn't it?
It has.
Let's hear some more.
Thank you.
Hesperion 20, directed by Jordi Savall, with Contrapunctus No. 8. You're listening to The Early Music Show on BBC Radio 3 with me, Lucy Skeeping. And today I'm looking at Bach's monumental last work, The Art of Fugue, with my guest, the Bach expert, Simon Hayes. So, Simon, was it intended for performance, do you think, or just for private study, perhaps for other composers to show people how to write fugues?
No, I think The Art of Fugue was definitely intended for performance, and the proof lies in the music itself. I mean, it's full of performance markings. There are staccato dots, ornaments and slurs, especially in the two-part canons. And Bach even adds the suggestion that the third canon should end with an improvised cadenza, and you're not going to put that in, you know, a purely theoretical piece of music. And also, if you compare Bach's autograph manuscript with the final printed edition, you can see that between the two, he adds more performance suggestions to the final printed edition to make the whole thing more legible and much easier to play.
Let's talk about instrumentation. It's not unusual for music, of course, from this pre-classical period, not to specify a particular instrument. You get all sorts of concertos which say it could be for oboe or flute or a violin, sometimes even a harpsichord. But The Art of Fugue seems to be laid out on the page in a quite unusual way. It's not a keyboard score and it's not written like an orchestral score. It's got this thing called open scoring. Can you explain that?
Well, the purpose of open scoring is to clarify the contrapuntal argument so that each line of the fugal web, as it were, is on a separate line so that you can see it very clearly. And there's a very strong 17th century tradition of publishing fugal music like this. Bach's predecessor, Samuel Scheidt, the organist, and the Italian harpsichordist, Girolamo Frescobaldi, both published works in open score like this, which look at fugal procedures. The interesting thing is they were always intended for study at the keyboard. And we know, actually, Bach studied Frescobaldi's works as a young man. And Frescobaldi's 12 fugal fantasias for keyboard of 1608 do exactly what The Art of Fugue does, a series of fugal pieces of increasing complexity. So it's possible that Frescobaldi and this sort of open score notation were the direct influence on Bach.
So do you think that it was written for the keyboard?
Yes, absolutely. I think the very clear reason for this is that it all works on the keyboard, apart from one or two pieces, which Immanuel Bach supplies a duet version of so that two people can play it. So all the music works on the keyboard, and the few sketches that survive in Bach's hand are actually in keyboard notation. They're not in this open score notation. So I think that Bach actually composed it at the keyboard.
So do you kind of not approve of, say, an orchestra playing it? Because we're going to hear one in a moment.
Well, no, actually, quite the opposite. I mean, the great bonus for posterity is the lack of instrumentation, because, of course, it's opened people's imaginations and they can use a variety of things. I think there's one golden rule, that the combination of instruments that are chosen must make the fugal argument absolutely clear. That's the only rule.
Thank you. we heard Contrapunctus No. 4, Musica Antiqua Köln, directed by Reinhard Goebel. Now, Simon, some people feel that the kind of style of the writing is rather old-fashioned for Bach's time, that he was looking back to the works of his predecessors rather than forward to all that new wonderful Rococo stuff that was just around the corner. Why do you think he would have done that, if that is the case?
Well, I think the earlier fugues certainly are in a more old-fashioned style, and they allude to a kind of 16th-century vocal style, the sort of thing that actually Monteverdi describes as the prima pratica. You know, he's like a gymnast proving that he can do all the basic exercises. He can go back to this earlier style. But as the art of fugue hots up, he does become more modern, particularly in the dance rhythms that he chooses to use and the kind of really quite extreme chromaticism as well. But I think that this actually misses the point. Fugal writing was considered by Bach and many of his contemporaries to be sort of timeless, really, standing above and beyond fashion. And in the printed preface to The Art of Fugue, the friend of the Bach family, Friedrich Marburg, actually talks about this sense of timelessness of fugues. And he uses some wonderful gendered imagery to bang home his point. He says, "Fugues are manly, and modern composers should learn to write them and avoid the hoppity melodification of fashionable music, which," he says, "is merely womanish rubbish."
We won't be allowing that kind of talk here on the BBC, I'm afraid. tell us about reception. How was The Art of Fugue received when it first appeared in 1751? I mean, that was just after Bach's death. Did anyone buy it?
Well, the sales figures are admittedly disappointing, it must be said. Bach's son Emmanuel tells us that just 30 copies were actually sold. I suspect that more copies were sold than this. I think the first edition was probably a sellout, and it was given away to Bach's friends, colleagues, university postholders and that sort of thing. A second edition was published almost immediately after, in 1752, and it was put up for sale at one of the great Leipzig book fairs at Easter 1752. And it gets a long preface by the Bach family friend Marburg, who we've already talked about. It's often said that you know, these sales were so bad that Emmanuel Bach advertises the copper plates on which it was printed for sale to be melted down for scrap. But actually, he advertises to publishers and says, "Look, this is a wonderful work. Why not reprint it? You know, it hasn't sold well simply because I've not had the time to promote it. So it's really a going concern." We don't know what happened, whether the Art of Fugue ever was reprinted. But what happens next is really the 18th century equivalent of CD ripping or file sharing. People started making their own handwritten copies of these printed editions. And it's these which circulate widely around Germany in the 18th century. And it's these which really perpetuate the name of Bach and the Art of Fugue.
Well, there's a blast from the past. That was Neville Marriner directing the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields with Bach's Contrapuntus No. 11 in four parts from, of course, the Art of Fugue that we're talking about today. Simon, one thing that creates a lot of confusion is that the work exists in more than one version. Can you explain? I mean, how do we know which is the right one?
Well, of course, there are lots of versions because it's Bach we're talking about here. You know, one of the inveterate revisers of music history. Yes, two distinct versions of the work survive. It's very simple, really. The early version is preserved complete in Bach's autograph, and it dates from around about 1742. There are 14 movements, 12 fugues and 2 canons. But, you know, Bach couldn't leave well alone, and he starts to tinker. And what he does is to, probably between about 1742 and 46, he changes the order of pieces, he revises them, extends them, and adds 4 entirely new movements. So the second version is the one that's actually printed in 1751, by which time we've got 2 new fugues, 2 canons, and a lot of flowers. It's a wonderfully beautiful printed edition on all the blank bits of the page that are not used up by music. The engraver has put a whole garden of flowers. Absolutely beautiful. I think it's the most florid of all his publications.
Davit Moroney playing the harpsichord in Contrapunctus No. 10. Well, I've already mentioned how in the past the Art of Fugue was thought to be Bach's swan song, if you like, his sort of final gift to the world in his last days. But how do we know that this wasn't the case? Because he was pretty old.
In the last decade of his life, Bach spent a long time revising and organising many of his earlier works and bringing them to a final sort of perfected form for his own pleasure and for posterity, probably both. The Art of Fugue was just one of these works, and we know he spent, you know, about a decade refining it. The B minor Mass was another such work which Bach assembled and revised and composed at around about the same time. But unlike the Art of Fugue, the B minor Mass was not intended for a complete performance. And it's interesting, the Et Incarnatus Est from the B minor Mass and the fourth and the final fugue in the Art of Fugue were actually the last things from Bach's pen. So the Art of Fugue then is just part of Bach's posterity planning, if you will. The only difference between this and his other final perfected scores was that he actually didn't really finish copying it out neatly. This final fugue was probably just about complete. He didn't finally make a neat copy, and it was a last-minute addition anyway. It really came at the last moment.
So would it be inaccurate to say that Bach intended the Art of Fugue to be a sort of summary of his amazing skill at fugue writing?
Well, I think it is both a summary and a pioneering work. In the last fugues, which Bach added, he showed new and exciting ideas about where fugal technique was going to go, at places it had never been explored before. And also, as I've said, we shouldn't see the Art of Fugue in isolation. Probably for Bach, it represented the summit of his aspirations in the fugal writing of abstract instrumental music. But it didn't address his colossal contribution to vocal or choral fugue writing. So the vocal counterpart, the twin, as it were, to the Art of Fugue, is actually the B minor Mass. And the choruses of the B minor Mass, like the Art of Fugue, demonstrate his achievements in choral fugal writing, which I think then takes him on to demonstrate many other aspects of his art. So of all the works, which is his last musical, last will and testament, I think it's not the Art of Fugue, I think it's the B minor Mass.
It's a sort of slightly gothic thing going on in the last movement, isn't there? Because he actually uses the letters of his own name to represent the notes. Explain how that works.
Yes, in the last seven bars, Bach introduces a theme whose opening four notes spell out his name, B-A-C-H. The Germans rather conveniently used the H as a B natural. That really helped Bach.
Didn't it just? And yet, Bach's son C.P.E. Bach commented that his father had died over this particular fugue, and many people have made lots of this because it's got a feeling of being unfinished in the sense that the score sort of breaks off abruptly. So people just deduced, I guess, that Bach was kind of dying and dropped his pen like a sort of, and used his name like a kind of sign-off.
No, this is all complete romantic fantasy. And I think C.P. Bach has been misunderstood. He actually decided not to print those last seven bars containing the Bach theme, which is in his father's manuscript. It made a very messy ending. So he actually brings the piece to a cadence before we get the B.A.C.H. theme. What's significant is that Johann Sebastian Bach's handwriting in his manuscript is firm and confident. You know, he's got a very, very keen grip on his quill.
And I should just say at this point that you've brought in a brilliant colour photocopy of the last page, which is all kind of blotchy. It wasn't anyone's tears, was it?
The blotchiness is just the way the ink has actually run into the very porous paper. What we should be looking at is, look how firm those note heads are, yeah. And the stems going down and the cross stems joining things together.
Incredibly clear. It doesn't look like anyone whose strength is failing.
No, his eyesight. It's definitely not going. Yeah. What's happened here is, as the music sort of gradually fades out, he's been called to supper. And I think he's left the room and he just never came back. Maybe, you know, after supper, that's when, you know, he had his eye troubles. But this is really an interruption to a copying process, not a composing process. He was simply copying up something neatly here, which had already been composed in draft.
Well, thanks so much, Simon. That was brilliant. I think you have definitely clarified a few things. We're going to end with a performance of the final fugue that's incomplete and poignantly hanging in mid-air. It's played on this recording by the viol group Phantasm. Simon Hayes, thank you very much. Until next time, goodbye.
That's how Bach left it. The final incomplete contrapuntus from the Art of Fugue by Johann Sebastian Bach, performed there by Phantasm. Today's Early Music Show was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced by Chris Wines. And you can also download a podcast of the programme by visiting the Early Music Show pages on the Radio 3 website. Next Sunday, Lucy celebrates the 25th anniversary of the Cardinal's music with its director, Andrew Carwood. That's at the same time next Sunday afternoon here on Radio 3, 2 o'clock. Well, back to today, and tonight's Radio 3 Live in Concert brings pianist Yuja Wang in recital at London's Barbican. I remember a fabulous Bartok second piano concerto from her at the Proms a year or two ago. Tonight she's playing a couple of third sonatas, Chopin's and Prokofiev's, Stravinsky's Petrushka, the three movements from, and Nikolai Kapustin's Variations. That all starts here on Radio 3 at 7:30 tonight. And if the name Nikolai Kapustin doesn't ring any bells, he's a Ukrainian in his 70s. Going back a decade or two, he had a second career as a jazz pianist. Well, this is one of Kapustin's preludes in jazz style, played here by Stephen Osborne. Number 11 of the Preludes in Jazz Style by Nikolai Kapustin. There are 24 preludes in all, inspired by Chopin's set. The pianist was Stephen Osborne. And Nikolai Kapustin's Variations, as I say, open the second half of Yuja Wang's recital in tonight's Radio 3 Live in Concert. It all starts here on Radio 3 at 7:30 tonight.
On the choir this afternoon on Radio 3, we'll be meeting a group formed by Gareth Malone in Manchester Airport. We'll be finding out how they've been getting on singing together since the cameras moved out. We've also got a special studio session from the American shape note singer Moira Smiley, who gathers together with eight singing friends to improvise. And my choral classic at 5 o'clock is Fauré's Requiem. Join me, Sarah Moore Peach, at 4 o'clock for the choir here on BBC Radio 3.
In other words, in an hour's time, it's 3 o'clock and time now for Choral Evensong, which is an edited repeat of last Wednesday's live broadcast from Lincoln Cathedral. The canticles in C minor were composed by Bernard Rose in 1968 for the Northampton Choir Musica Nova. And the anthem is All Wisdom Cometh from the Lord, composed by Philip Moore in 1980 to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the founding of Guildford Cathedral's choir school. The service opens now with an introit by the young Herbert Howells, composed in 1915 for the choir of Westminster Cathedral. Regina Caeli, Queen of Heaven, Rejoice.
Good afternoon and welcome to Lincoln Cathedral on this very windy afternoon for this service of choral evensong. A particular welcome to those of you joining us for this service on Radio 3. The service continues now with the office hymn For a Wednesday. Please be seated as the choir sing Psalm 91, the words of which you'll find on page 464 of most editions of the small black books of Common Prayer.